Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, proud supporter of live music and driven to think big about beer since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Think big about beer.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to review the new album from Courtney Barnett, Tell Me How You Really Feel, Jim. But first, singer and songwriter John Prine.
I ain't got nobody hanging around my doorstep. Ain't got no loose change, just a hanging around my jeans. If you see somebody, would you send them over my way? I could use some help here with a can of pork and beans.
That's a little bit of the song Knocking on Your Screen Door by singer-songwriter John Prine off his latest album, The Tree of Forgiveness. John Prine has been making music since the late 60s. You know, the famous story about John Prine is he started out delivering the mail in Maywood, Illinois.
Yeah.
And on his route, he was writing these songs, including some stone-cold classics like Sam Stone and Hello in There. This guy wrote a bunch of tunes, finally debuted them at a club in Chicago, was reviewed by none other than Roger Ebert, the famed film critic.
My friend and colleague.
Caught a show. It was one of the first big reviews that Prine got. His career took off from there.
Greg, you know, the list of people who look up to John Prine, Johnny Cash,
yeah.
Bonnie Raitt, Kris Kristofferson, Paul Westerberg, Dwight Yoakam, oh yeah, and that guy Bob Dylan. You know, those are some of the many admirers. I think that there are artists who are songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after Townes Van Zandt, number two on that list is John Prine. He's worked in the major label system. He started his own indie label at the height of the indie 80s, 1984, Oh Boy Records. You know, John had a really tough battle with cancer in 1998 on the right side of his neck. It left his voice deeper, more gravelly. You'll hear that when we're talking to him. But he's bounced back. He's continuing to make music. He's better than ever. Arguably. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So, John, let's start at the beginning of your career. You know, I mean, you're working as this postal carrier in your 20s, and during this time, you're writing these amazing multi-layered songs. How did that work?
Not to put down the job of a mailman, but once you know that route, there's nothing you're like in a library with no books. All day long, you got all this time on your hands to think about stuff. It was a perfect, I need to be doing something else when I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be thinking that I'm actually a writer and sitting there, well, I'm going to write a song today. Only once did I deliver the mail to the wrong street, every house on the wrong street.
That must have been a day that gave you a particularly good song.
And I had to go back at 8 o'clock at night and knock on every door and get the mail back. It was very embarrassing for a mailman. Yeah.
When I woke up this morning, things were looking bad. Seemed like total silence was the only friend I had. A bowl of oatmeal tried to stare me down and won. And it was 12 o'clock before I realized I was having no fun.
I'm curious too, John, because you got up on stage at the Fifth Peg in the Old Town neighborhood when the folk scene was starting to explode, and you played like three songs, I guess. And they blew everybody away. You're writing these masterpieces, like almost like your first public performance, and you're doing songs like Hello in There, right? And Sam
right.
Stone was in there. How many songs did you have to write in your head before you got to a place where you're writing songs of that quality, or was it just pouring
not
out?
Not many.
Yeah?
I started writing when I was 14, and then it was totally a hobby. But I found some of those songs when I did my second album, Diamond in the Rough. And I cut two of the songs I wrote when I was 14 years old. I found a tape of me singing The Frying Pan, Sour Grapes, and Twist and Shout. And I knew that I didn't write Twist and Shout. So I cut the other two. And they were the same as the kind of stuff that I was writing at 24.
Wow.
I don't care if the sun don't shine, but better all people will wonder. No man, if it ever quits raining, except the kids are afraid of the thunder, see sour grapes. You can laugh and stare, see sour grapes. I don't care.
I after the Army is when I started writing again. I kind of dropped it. It was just a hobby. And I started writing when I got home from the Army early 68. So 68 and 69 were just about the whole first record.
You can't talk about the Chicago folk scene in the 60s and 70s without mentioning Steve Goodman, who was a great songwriter and performer. You know, City of New Orleans, and also that Cubs song that people around here seem to like. He was a close friend of yours for many years until he died in 84. What did you think of Steve Goodman when you first met him, John?
He'd already had City of New Orleans. I'd heard it on the Midnight Special. They played a cassette of Steve. He didn't have a record deal.
Riding on the City of New Orleans, Illinois Central Monday morning rail. There are 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors and 25 sacks of mail.
And I had pictured Steve. I didn't meet him yet. I thought he was about 6'2", real skinny guy with a kind of like a Maynard Krebs sort of guy, right?
Uh-huh.
That's why I pictured him. So when I first meet him, this guy, he's 5'0". He walks up and starts poking me in the chest going, "Hey, I'm Steve Goodman. How are you? You know, you're John Prine." You know? And it was immediate. We became buddies right away.
I got to explain the cultural reference for everybody younger than me and Greg. Maynard G. Krebs, right. Dobie Gillis.
Yeah.
The archetypal beatnik.
Exactly.
You know, Gilligan before the island. You know, my perception, I wasn't here, John. You know, my perception of the folk years in Chicago is, in Chicago, there's no BS, right? You can't be fronting. You can't be thinking you're Maynard Krebs or Jack Kerouac, right?
Yeah.
What, it had to be a little tougher in Chicago to begin as a folk singer-songwriter.
It was, but mainly because of my songs, I was pretty much welcomed like right away, you know, especially by the old guard, like Bob Gibson, Joe Mapes, and people like that. All came down to the Fifth Peg to see me, and the word got around really quick.
We had an apartment in the city. Me and Loretta like living there. Well, it's been years since the kids had grown a life of their own and left us alone.
You got, you know, a lot of notice early on. Roger Ebert famously wrote up your show, and Kris Kristofferson was in the audience, blown away. You know, there was an immediate sort of, you know, hubbub around John Prine and this great new folk singer. What sort of pointed you in the direction of, you know, that acoustic guitar and writing those folk songs versus, you know, just doing a rock and roll band in Chicago in the late 60s?
Well, my oldest brother, Dave Prine, who still lives out in Maywood, Dave taught me how to play when I was 14. He was into old-timey music, like New Lost City Ramblers.
I'm going where there's no depression, to the lovely land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble. My home's in heaven, I'm going there.
And Dave taught me rhythm guitar so he could practice his fiddle. If you've ever been around somebody who's teaching himself how to play the fiddle, you have to be a loved one. Otherwise, you run.
Boy, it's brutal. It is painful.
But he taught me how to play really fast rhythm, and it was all old-timey country.
Mm-hmm.
So what I maintained, because I was a huge rock and roll fan, if somebody were taught me Chuck Berry, how to play the guitar like Chuck Berry's songs, I would be writing in a whole different genre.
Mm-hmm.
But he taught me about folk. He laid a couple of records on me, Carter Family.
Out in the cold world and far away from home, somebody's boy is wandering alone.
John Hurt, Elizabeth Cotton, and I learned their style of picking. And I learned about 5 Carter Family songs, and I started writing songs. Boom. It was too hard for me to memorize their words. So I wrote my own words to other tunes, and then started writing my own tunes.
You know, the other thing that was interesting to me about your early career is there must have been a certain amount of push to, like, you know, let's go a little more rock. Let's anthem up these songs a little bit. Let's put some rock instrumentation on there. You seem to always resist that impulse to get that anthemic quality into the songs. There was no easy sing-alongs there necessarily in terms of just like a rock song.
Right.
Your songs always struck me as kind of being emotionally ambiguous. Like you didn't tell the listener how to feel. And you certainly couldn't write a chorus that was going to be shouted up in an arena, like, you know.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to tell the record companies this at the time, but now that I look back, I got a pretty good view of what I did now and why I did it, and I didn't want a hit. Mm-hmm. To me, a hit was like that's a bookmark in your career, so you're never going to be as good as that hit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a hit, you got longevity, you know, and I thought I had the kind of perfect balance to have really good stuff coming in from the critics and have an audience that did not care. Well, when I started my own record company, people sent in money for the next record. I hadn't read it. I hadn't named it.
Mm-hmm.
They sent in money and said, whatever you do, send me the next record. Here's $15. You can't beat that.
Yeah. So
take it back. Take it back. Oh, no. The black wind still moans, sweet revenge, sweet revenge without fail.
So you were a pioneer in this crowdsourcing notion.
They all told me I was crazy, and I was throwing my career away.
1984, Oh Boy starts, right?
Yes.
So in the indie rock world, you know, we had seen Patti Smith release an independent single, and then it kind of begins to percolate through the punk years. But what made you think it was a good idea to become a record company owner, investor, you know, in 84? Now everybody has to be independent, right? But you were ahead of the curve.
Even the ones that aren't truly independent,
right.
they just come up with a name and then
right.
Sony like finances them. It wasn't because I didn't like the major labels. They were more frustrated than me. They didn't know how to market me. And I always tried to, whatever song I wrote, that would dictate the production. That's the way, if the song was a folk song, do it like a folk song. If it sounds like a rock song, then bring in some electric guitars and mm-hmm. drums. And the record company never really tried to change me. They didn't come in and say, we need this kind of record. They didn't give me any kind of direction, matter of fact. And I just thought it was very frustrating for them and me. And I had the dedicated audience. I could sell my own records to them. Might not be the same numbers, but I know how I make my living. And that's what I based the independent record company on, just to purely put out just my label, my records. I wasn't trying to sign a bunch of acts and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
That may change now. Now that I got some people's attention.
You come home late and you come home early. You come home big when you're feeling small. Come home straight and you come home curly. Sometimes you don't come home at all.
I've read this now in a bunch of interviews you've been doing for the new album. How does one sit down and write a song with Phil Spector?
It wasn't planned.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with Robert Hilburn, wrote for the LA
sure.
Times?
Okay. Sure, great rock critic.
Yeah, and he was an early champion of my stuff, at mm-hmm. least in the LA area. And I got to L.A. to do something. I think the record company had moved out there. And I ran into Robert Hilburn, and he says, I asked him what he'd been up to. And he says he's trying to write a book on Phil Spector, and he's at his house every night interviewing him. I said, really? And he goes, yeah, you want to come with me? And I said, Phil Spector wouldn't know me. And he said he was quoting Donald and Lydia the other night. So I said, great, I'll come out there. Well, it was like a circus. I mean, it was the Phil Spector show.
Mm-hmm.
He has two bodyguards. It doesn't matter if he goes to the bathroom or upstairs or downstairs.
They're with him.
He's got a little weasel-looking guy and a guy who looked like Chewbacca. And
man.
All of them are carrying heat.
Yeah, including him,
including
right?
Spector.
Spector's got a
guy. He's got a three-piece suit with two handguns on either side and shoulder holster. His kids come running down the stairs in their pajamas, and he goes, "Who's the king of rock and roll?" And they go, "You are, Daddy.
Oh, my God. They're trained."
It was pretty much a show. And so 4 hours later, I say, "Well, I got to go. I'm going to go back to my hotel." Phil walks me to the door. We pass by a piano. He sits down, hands me an unplugged electric, and we write, "If You Don't Want My Love." So I go home to Chicago. Goodman and I go in the studio. We cut the song. Next time I'm in L.A., I take it out there to play it for Phil before the record comes out.
If you don't want my love, if you don't want my love, if you don't want my love. Anymore.
Same deal. He had just finished the Leonard Cohen record, and it hadn't come out yet. He took me in the snooker room, put Leonard Cohen on 11, and the snooker balls were vibrating on the table. And that night when I leave, we pass by the piano, sit down, 30 minutes we write, God Only Knows, but I had to add some stuff. I had to write another verse and a bridge for it. But I will say this, when he sits down and plays, totally no nonsense.
Yeah.
All of a sudden he becomes, you know.
The act is over.
The act is totally over. So, but I heard the act was always on when he was producing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was his show. He'd come in and call a session like that, you know, and drop 50
I've talked
people.
To the Ramones about making the record with him, and they were scared to death. you sent him the record, the recording of God Only Knows, in prison.
Yeah, we haven't, at least through his people, you know, so I haven't heard back, but I bet if they send him the charts, I bet he's happy to have a record out there.
Yeah.
So you're hanging out with Sam Phillips, you're hanging out with Phil Spector, you're writing a song about, do I continue this for another 30 years or whatever, which obviously you decided to do that, but what was the decision-making in your own mind? You obviously forged ahead and turned this into, you know, a remarkable career at that point.
To me, the way it looks, in retrospect, I did just about everything to wreck it, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, but I kept on writing, I kept on going out and singing. And luckily, my audience just followed whatever I went through. They came with me, whether they liked it or not. I mean, I had a lot of people didn't like the rockabilly thing, the pink Cadillac. I said I couldn't have gone on further if I didn't stay true to what I wanted to do at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I'm glad I did what I did at the time. Instead of, otherwise it would have been nothing. I would have just gone to heck with it.
I've been a bad boy, I've been long gone, I've been out there, I never phoned home, I never gave you not one a little clue where I'd been. I've been a bad boy again.
When we come back, more with our guest John Prine. We'll talk about the origin of some of his greatest songs, and he'll tell the story of how he turned down Sony Music to start his own independent label. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. I